I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The pressure on mothers these days is unrelenting. Social media, TV, and technology have some women believing they have to have it all, a catalog-worthy house, happy children, and perfectly coiffed hair at all times. But is the burden burning some moms out? Today we'll find out how shifting those expectations can lead to a happier mother and a healthier family. Then an update on the construction and property development happening in Kansas City, Missouri. From River Market to Midtown, apartments are being built and renovated at a blistering pace. But is the boom beginning to soften? And what should we expect from the special streetcar election going on right now? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. So often these days, moms want to be perfect. They want to raise perfect kids, meaning they want to host perfect birthday parties, serve great, healthy meals every day, look terrific themselves, and oversee a neat, well-organized home. Well, that's awfully tough to pull off, and the result is a whole lot of moms out there are exhausted, overwhelmed, and even lonely. Cheryl Ziegler writes about all this in her new book, Mommy Burnout: How to Reclaim Your Life and Raise Healthier Children in the Process. Dr. Ziegler is the founder and managing director of the Child and Family Therapy Center at Lowry, that's based in Denver. She's a doctor of psychology and a licensed professional counselor. Dr. Ziegler, Cheryl, nice to have you. Good morning. You there? Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, Cheryl, how are you? Welcome.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm really glad you're there, actually. That's great. You've got three kids yourself, Cheryl. I'm wondering how much of this wanting to be the perfect mom is something that you've struggled with yourself?
Oh, I've definitely struggled. And I think that's why I was able to really write this book. It was certainly inspired by the clients and patients that I see in my practice. But it wasn't until I had my second child that I actually felt that burnout of just having, I had a baby and a toddler at home, still trying to run my practice and advance my career. And it was the first time I had those feelings of like, I'm just barely coming up for breath. Like I could sometimes not have enough hours in the day. So I have struggled with it. And I've also gotten so much help just from researching this book and connecting with thousands of moms.
You know, you said in a TED Talk that you were lonely and so busy and so hectic that you didn't even know you were lonely.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I didn't know that I was disconnected. So I think that I used to have the mindset that, you know, like I didn't have time to make new friends. I had plenty of friends. You know, I'd be like, oh my gosh, I have plenty of friends. I don't have time for new friends. And then once the, you know, as I point out in the TED Talk, once I was in the hospital and sitting there alone because my husband was home with our kids, we don't have any family that lives here in the city, I thought, who could I call? Like, who could I really call right now that would care? And, you know, not because I need something, because there were people I could call if I needed something, but just a friend who would say, oh my gosh, I can't believe, you know, you're having a kidney stone attack in the hospital. And that is really when it smacked me in the face.
You know, the title of this book, Mommy Burnout, it's for a specific kind of condition you saw in your mom clients. Why give this its own name instead of just calling it simply, you know, anxiety or stress?
Yeah, that's really a great question, because I have really seen that in some ways, I think that burnout today is viewed as an extension of depression. And from my own experience and doing the research, I really think it is its own distinct category, because I think you can be burned out, meaning that you are emotionally and physically exhausted. You have this sense of reduced personal accomplishment, and you have this prolonged exposure to stress because you never stop being a mom. And so I think you can have those situations and not experience depression. And I think you can also experience depression and not be burned out on anything. So I actually really have contemplated whether I do think that they're the same. And I think they're really quite different from each other.
You know, many of your stories are about mothers who were bringing their kids to see you, and yet the moms are the ones who ended up being the ones who were really your patients. Why weren't they seeking you out on their own?
You know, what I find is that moms will do anything for their kids, and we put ourselves last, you know? So I will say to moms, when's the last time you got a physical? I mean, they're just looking at me like they have no idea, yet they absolutely know that on their child's birthday, you know, their child is getting a physical. Or when's the last time you did anything for self-care? And so there's that piece. There's women don't make time for themselves, and every bit of energy they have, they put toward their kids. There's also the second piece where I think we as a society have accepted that being completely frazzled and stressed out and with no time for yourself is just called motherhood today. And so there's also that normalizing of this process that I really want to see changed.
Cheryl Ziegler is my guest. Her new book, Mommy Burnout, How to Reclaim Your Life and Raise Healthier Children in the Process. What are the symptoms when a mom's stress evolves, you know, from acute stress to something like chronic stress?
Yeah. So when you have acute stress, you have feelings maybe of, you know, you're feeling negative, maybe you're feeling resentful, you're feeling overwhelmed for a short period of time. But what happens is you say, oh, I got a good night's sleep, or oh, that argument with my spouse is over, or whatever happened at work that's stressing me out is done. And that you kind of feel like you get back to yourself. And so that's when you would know, sure, you had acute stress on a daily basis. Absolutely, all of us have acute stress. When it's chronic stress is when it just keeps going. You don't really feel like there's an end in sight. And even when you do, let's say, supposedly get a good night's sleep, or maybe even go away for the weekend with your spouse or girlfriend or something like that, you still don't really feel like you're yourself. You don't bounce back. And that's when you know that chronic stress has worn on you to the point where you're coming closer. You are already at burnout, and not just a weekend away is going to make things better.
You know, one of the points you make in the book is all of this chronic stress, this ongoing stress that we're talking about here, winds up having a long-term impact on health. And people a lot of times don't recognize that connection.
Yes. And, you know, I would say that even for me, when I really was doing the deep dive into the impact on our physical health, I was really surprised by the impact of loneliness or lack of social connection with others, the impact that that has on us, as well as just, you know, never really thinking about that the stress that we're experiencing in motherhood causes us to have increased rates of diabetes, increased rates of obesity, increased muscle tension. I hear a lot about, you know, headaches and stomach aches and those kinds of things, but it even reaches beyond that. And that was really surprising to me. It really gave me pause, and I felt like it was something that needed to be shared with other moms.
There are several different types of stress responses. Run us through that.
So you can have an emotional stress response where you are, you know, you're feeling resentful maybe of your kids, you're feeling negative, you might be feeling feelings of depression or anxiety. So there's an emotional component of just this, you find that your mindset has really changed and it's really hard to snap out of. And then there's the physical response to stress, which what I thought was really interesting. So that's everything from your heart rate and your muscle tension. But what I found was really interesting was a study on stress that said, came out of UCLA and really said that men are the ones that are really a lot more aligned with the notion of fight, flight, or freeze, and that women were more in line with the stress response of tend and befriend. That when women are under tremendous stress, what we are sort of wired for is to tend to our children and befriend other women. And so from that, I thought, wow, that really makes sense. And what I think has gone awry in today's society is that we're over-tending to our kids and we're actually under-befriending our friends.
I was going to say, there is that whole notion of helicopter parents, and it seems like, you know, my generation was really guilty of that, and you're suggesting that it's very much continuing.
It is continuing. And what really underlies that, because when I talk about this with women, I never want them to feel judged or like, oh, great, here's another thing I'm doing wrong. So what I say to them is, all of these behaviors that we're all exhibiting, actually the underlying motivational feeling is fear. because we have two primary emotions. We have love and fear. Mm-hmm. And all those feeling horns underneath that either come from love or they come from fear. So I think by understanding, just having that awareness that when we're hovering over our kids, when we're overtending to our kids, we have this fear that if we don't, then it'll reflect poorly on us as a parent, or our child won't get ahead, or they're lagging behind in some way. And so it's almost like fear-based parenting is what the norm is today.
I thought we were supposed to be sort of over, you know, recognizing our mistakes from the current generation and maybe trying to move on.
Right. And if anything, things are really getting worse when you see the rates of depression, anxiety, and certainly suicide. All it's saying to us is that women and children are really suffering from, we are in absolutely a mental health crisis right now. And these rates of depression and anxiety are epidemic, not just for women, but also for children. So what really our data is saying is that things are getting worse. And some of the things that are fueling that have to do with social media and a 24/7 media cycle that we can't get away from. And so when you are sharing all of your highlights with everybody, what happens is other moms wind up feeling pretty poorly about themselves and making decisions maybe for their families or for themselves that are driven by the wrong kinds of motivating factors.
Well, if our listeners want to chime in here, our guest is saying we have an epidemic of anxiety and depression when it comes to our mothers out there, and that obviously is not a good thing. 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888. If you can relate, give us a shout and tell us what you're doing about it. Option two is to tweet us at KCUR up to date. You just mentioned social media. What does that have to do with this?
So what we know, and I can't give you a solid number because I have found numbers that range all over from 19 hours a week to 30 plus hours a week. But all I know is that we are spending probably more than 2 waking days of our lives on social media. And so what that does, and we're just spending a lot of time online. And so what that does is it bombards us with information. It sort of replaces face-to-face contact. So if I have a question, let's say about, you know, I want to switch pediatricians, certainly a millennial mom, but even today's Gen X moms are very likely to just go online, look for reviews, look through websites, and find people that way. So it's replacing our face-to-face opportunities to make connection, and it's tons of images. And so the research says that the more beautiful, perfect, Pinterest-worthy images that we are getting exposed to, the worse we feel about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying here, and I don't want our time together to get away without resolving some of these problems by offering some solutions, face-to-face interaction with other moms is obviously key here, and you talk about that in the book.
It really is. Relationships with other women. And what I'll share is that I used to have the notion, like I started saying in the beginning, of that I didn't have time for new friends. And I really had plenty of friends, so I didn't really need to invest in that time. And I really was wrong about that. Now I have an appreciation that not every woman that I meet has to become my very best friend in the world. I now have mom friends and neighbor friends and church friends, and I call them senior mommy friends, and I also have junior mommy friends. So moms that are older than me that I'm learning from their wisdom, moms that are 10 years younger than me because we're raising our kids side by side, that I feel like more of a mentor too. I now have a much broader spectrum of women in my life, and I'm so much more connected and fulfilled for it.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. We're talking with Cheryl Ziegler about her new book, Mommy Burnout, and the title says it all. Courtney from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad you're doing this show.
Oh, good.
Cheryl, I want to say thank you for naming mommy loneliness in all of this. A lot of people don't talk about that. I'm a working single mom, and I'm actually home with a sick kid right now, so I feel sort of lonely and separate from the world. I wanted to ask you about the online mom community, because I know that you talk about how sometimes the online world and social media can create more pressure, but how do you feel about the mom blogs and the mom Facebook accounts and those types of things in terms of helping mothers realize that this happens to other people too?
Courtney, that is really such a great question. So when I go around and I speak, I say, here's the deal. These mommy bloggers and comedians and movies like Bad Moms, they have done us a service. They have used humor to absolutely uncover what we were all feeling, let's say 5 to 8 years ago, and definitely nobody was talking about. So I absolutely applaud all of those kinds of mommy bloggers and humorous sites and memes and all of those things that go, oh my gosh, I thought it was just me, and you laugh, and that makes you feel connected. And so what I say is, I'm now here to say, that's all great, but actually, this isn't funny. You know, having record levels of feeling lonely and alcoholism, depression, and
Oh
anxiety,
my God.
we now need to know, we need to take what we know and actually do something about it because it's actually quite serious.
Thank you.
Courtney, I'm glad you
You're
called.
welcome.
Thank you. Let's go to Karen from the Midtown area. Karen, good morning. We're talking about burned out mothers. Nice to have you.
Good morning. So I've always considered myself a quote unquote normal mom. I've kind of been recently catapulted into probably insane mom because our family just took on a medically complex foster child. And what it's done for me is instantly like all the things that your guest is speaking about, like asking for help, putting yourself out there. I do not have the luxury anymore not to do. Like, if I don't ask for help, our family will drown. And if I don't maybe cut out some of the extraneous activities that we feel pressured as moms to participate in with our kids, our family will not, we just will not survive. And so the normal little everyday stressors that add up to burnout, are no, I mean, I'm experiencing more stress than I ever have in my life because I'm going up to the hospital on a daily basis. But at the same time, my time with my biological children has become so precious and so I've let all the unimportant things kind of go to the wayside, and it's really quickly teaching me a lot of the important lessons that your guest was talking about. So.
Karen, thank you. And you talk at the end of the book, you switch the focus a bit and you talk about child burnout, Cheryl. What does that look like and what can you do about it?
Well, one of the things I want to say just to that last caller that just commented was there really is a big piece for moms that we do need to learn how to ask for help. That's part A. And then part B is learn how to receive the help. It's really hard. So she's in a really tough situation where it feels like not optional, the way she put it. So she's doing it. And I want women to feel this way, even when they're not in that kind of pressured situation. Everyday motherhood, because we can't wait for the crisis to finally go, oh, yeah, I really need help. I'm drowning here. We need to do that ahead of time. So that's, I just wanted to comment on that. She made a really great point. And, you know, in terms of what this is doing to our children, when you look at how American children are doing, they are mirroring us. Record levels of depression and anxiety, and the statistics on suicide are, you know, take your breath away. We have increased rates of suicide over the last decade. They just keep going up and up and up in the childhood population. And when they say childhood, the age range they start at is typically 6 years old. We have children committing suicide, not just teenagers and adolescents. And so when they are mirroring kind of what's happening with us, I just think that we are all interconnected. And if we show that life is hurried and rushed and addicted to a screen, you don't look up and connect with people, you are just kind of running from one place to the other, typically just barely on time. That's what we're doing. We're causing our kids to feel like they have a lot of pressure and they need to be filling every second of their day with things. And we don't value human needs like downtime, leisure time, just true hobbies and activities, family time. All of those things are really going more by the wayside because we have this compulsive need to sort of fill every minute of our day. And it's really detrimental to us.
Well, there's still this notion out there that, you know, you got to take care of the needs of your child. That comes first, and then this notion that you come after that is what you're talking about here. So what do you do? Your kid's throwing a temper tantrum, not eating the food you put in front of them, not doing their homework. It's wearing you down. And you still wonder how you can manage the needs of the kid and also take care of yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. Every mom should have the visual on the airplane of that oxygen mask falling down, and they always show the mother putting it on first, the children come second. Because if mom can't breathe, that child's not going to be able to breathe either. So, you know, that exact example you just gave, your kid's having a tantrum and you don't know what to do. You know, in that moment, instead of trying to fix the tantrum, or more than likely trying to fix everyone's discomfort around you, especially if you're in public, that's what really drives us, is we're like, oh, right, my gosh, everyone's staring at us. You take a breath, you walk away, you count to 10, you distract yourself. You say, I need to get myself together, because if not, I'm either going to yell at this kid, I'm going to drag him out by one arm, or I'm going to give in and I'm going to give them the cookie that they're tantruming for before they eat their lunch, just so they can be quiet.
Right. In the book, there's a special section about being your own advocate. What are some of the signs that you need to be your own advocate and even seek professional help for your burnout?
Yeah, so you need to be able to, again, ask for help, receive help, and stop hiding behind things like, you know, there's certain signs that I know women talk to me about, like they're overeating at night, they're avoiding sexual encounters with their spouse, they're even avoiding contact with family members, so they're texting or using social media to communicate as opposed to getting in touch with someone in person. And so really being able to say, this isn't normal. I cry by myself in the bathroom and nobody knows it. I overeat at night, or I'm undereating. I drive around the block several times before I get home because I feel so stressed at the notion of walking through the door. All of those things are signs that you are under a chronic amount of stress, and without some sort of intervention, you're going to be burned out and a less present, loving, effective mother and partner.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. That's Cheryl Ziegler. She's talking about her new book, Mommy Burnout, How to Reclaim Your Life and Raise Healthier Children in the Process. Cheryl, great advice. I'm sorry to hear about the epidemic, but it sounds like you're trying to do something about it.
I sure am. Thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. Thanks so much. Time for a break. When we come back, Kevin Carlson will join us to give us an update on all the development downtown and around the city these days. Lots of construction cranes everywhere. We'll find out what's going on. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last Wednesday, the former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, made some news about the 2020 presidential race, and he did it right here. You can find out what that was at kcur.org/uptodate. Last year, removing Confederate statues from public places made the news, and I even proposed that it's time to rename the J.C. Nichols Fountain. Seems like we have a history of targeting public art in this country, and we'll learn more about the when and the why tomorrow. That's on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, lots of development, if you will, in the development scene in Kansas City these days. An official groundbreaking for a new convention hotel took place last week. The apartment boom continues around town, but is demand starting to soften? There's new development occurring east of Troost. Tax credits for low-income housing and historic buildings are under debate, and plans to extend the streetcar continue. There's lots of issues to cover, and the man to do it for us is Kevin Carlson. He's editor-in-chief of City Scene KC. That's an online news site devoted to coverage of the greater downtown area. You can find it at cityscenekc.com. And Kevin, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Thanks for the shout-out.
Ground for the downtown convention center was broken last week down by the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. This has been a long, long time in coming. Why did it take so long?
Well, one of the biggest things, yeah, it goes back at least 30 years. People tell me that Ross Perot Jr., the Texas billionaire, made a big pitch to do a convention hotel in that particular part of downtown.
Right.
And that went away. What happened was, you know, the city wanted to do a convention hotel, and it had been a goal for quite a long time. And what got in the way was most of these cities like Denver and Dallas that have built these big convention hotels, either the city helped finance it or they backed the financing with their the city taxpayer dollars. And we had a situation here where the Power and Light District was built, and it originally was built on the premise that the additional tax revenues it would generate would pay off the debt. And the city, though, did back that bond issue that went into the Power and Light District, and it turned out the math didn't work out the way the proponents had hoped. So the city's been on the hook for $12, $14 million a year to backfill what's not being covered by the new tax revenues being generated.
And you think, by with all this development down there, that all these new people coming down, that that deficit might begin to ease up a little bit.
You would think, and I'm not sure what the new numbers are, but people are pretty much resigned to the fact that the city's going to have to subsidize that deal till the bonds are paid off. So, but getting back to the hotel, everybody said, look, you know, we do not want to run into this situation again. We do not want to have the city's credit backing the money involved with building this hotel. So that made it a lot more difficult a deal to put together than what you see in other major cities with these convention hotels. So finally, they did come up with a financing arrangement that had a $50 million investment from Lowe's, which is this major convention hotel operator out of New York. The city did kick in $35 million in cash, which is going to be paid by the hotel bed tax. And they also chipped in a city parking lot that is at the site. So that's the city's contribution. The rest of the funding is going to be paid off by the revenues generated by the hotel.
Right.
So the city did finally get the deal that people were – that they'd promised that they weren't going to, again, get back into the same situation they did with Cordish and the Power and Light District. So that's what took a lot of struggles, because again, a lot of these big convention hotels around the country all have some kind of city support or backing on the financing.
Some people might wonder, is there enough demand in downtown Kansas City for these rooms to make this 800 room downtown convention hotel work?
Right.
And be
that's
a success?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was also a huge question that people like the folks who run the hotels at Crown Center had wondered about the downtown Marriott. They didn't want this thing to be poaching business from them. You know, the proof will be in the pudding. We've got a couple of major conventions that have signed on because of this convention hotel. The Shriners are coming shortly after this place opens, and they're going to bring 20,000 people. There was another large convention that the folks at the Visit KC announced. It will be we'll find out. I mean, a lot of people have said, like, when the Future Farmers of America left Kansas City back 20 mm-hmm. years ago, and when Walmart ended its convention here 10 years ago, whatever, I'm giving, throwing out some just raw dates, it was because we just didn't have enough hotel rooms. So the big question is going to be, is Visit KC, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, going to be able to land these larger conventions that have been skipping Kansas City because we just didn't have enough hotel rooms? And that'll be, you know, the true test of whether this investment in this hotel is going to pay off.
You know, the man pushing this for so many years was Mike Burke. He's a councilman, a former councilman who ran for mayor a few years ago and wound up losing to Sly James. This is a case study in perseverance, isn't it? Because Mike has worked on this for years.
Mike has pushed this boulder up the hill quite a long time. He really has. And it was kind of funny at the dedication, the mayor made a joke saying that, referring to the election back in, when he challenged Burke, he said that Burke actually had won and Sly had lost. I guess revealing a little bit that he's getting a little worn out in the mayor's office these days.
There's another election going on right now to expand the downtown streetcar line south to the plaza and over to UMKC. There's a series of elections here to expand the streetcar, and this is the big one. It actually raises the sales tax by 1% in the development district around the streetcar line. This proposal is still expected to pass, isn't it, Kev?
It came up last week at a meeting of the downtown council. Jan Markison, who's on the Transportation Development District Board, they're feeling pretty good. Everything that's been transpired so far on these mail-in ballots for this extension out to UMKC has been handily approved by about a 70% majority.
And again, only voters who live in the district get to vote here.
Exactly. That's one of the things about this that has made it doable. You know, we've had a couple of major citywide elections that went down in flames for rail. They've come back now with these transportation development districts, which basically create a corridor on each side of the streetcar line where people who live there can vote on it. And yeah, this is the last election they need to actually establish the revenue sources for the district. But none of this stuff will have, I mean, if it's approved, it still will have to wait to find out whether the feds are going to come through with what is, I believe, to be over $100 million ask to get this thing built out to UMKC.
And that's increasingly iffy these days in the
Who
wake
knows?
Of federal budget deficits and everything else, right? That's not a hold-your-breath kind of moment, is it?
If I could predict how Washington responds to anything these days, I could be a great consultant and make lots of money.
Okay. If our listeners want to join our conversation, please do so. 816-235-2888. We're talking about development downtown and around Kansas City with Kevin Collison of City Scene KC. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So the streetcar thing is in the – how big of a deal is this right now? This is – we're taking it from the toy train aspect of the streetcar system, as it was once dubbed, to something that might be a lot more utilitarian.
Well,
right?
It would definitely be a huge plus to get it out to UMKC. You'd have a real destination. You'd really energize the corridor. And I got to tell you, you know, the streetcar authority just came out with a study a couple of weeks ago, referring back to your toy train comment. They did find out that it has become, in its short period of time, even though it just runs between Crown Center and the River Market, a major way for people to get back and forth downtown. And I think only around 7 or 8% of the people that they surveyed who ride it were just doing it just for kicks and, you know, to have fun.
So it already is utilitarian.
And I might add also that I had an interesting, what I thought was an interesting story the other day in City Scene. There is some serious conversation to extend it. Right now there's a plan to extend it down to the Berkeley Riverfront Park, and the Port Authority's been very interested in helping finance that. But now there's some discussions really by folks to take it all the way to the Isle of Capri Casino, which would create another destination on the north end of it, would help tremendously a casino that's been struggling for years. And also, as people pointed out, there's a lot of parking around that casino that is never used. So you could get a nice park and ride setup with folks coming in from the Northland, parking their car at the huge parking lot around Isle of Casino and hopping on the streetcar and getting into downtown. So you could foreseeably in 5 years, maybe, be able to hop on a streetcar at UMKC and take it all the way to the Isle of Capri.
And a lot of people out there are thinking right now, the Isle of Capri better pitch in and pay for some of that streetcar.
It would be hugely beneficial to the Isle of Capri to have customers from all these downtown hotels in town for conventions to be able to just hop on a free streetcar and go down and, you know, play some slots for a bit and then come back to their convention.
You know, there's a little controversy about some downtown workers parking at the northern end of the streetcar line in the River Market, then taking the line to work as a way to save on parking. What's happening on that front?
Well, the City Market folks have imposed a fee now to park in those parking lots during weekdays. So it was basically really designed to discourage people from doing exactly that kind of an informal park and ride. Now the free parking, I think it began on March 1st, is no longer available in the City Market controlled parking lots. And the city has been putting meters in down in the River Market area, and they expect to have all the major streets with meters here. So that opportunity is going away fast.
Let's go to some phone calls here for Kevin Collison of City Scene KC. Let's go to Doug from the East Village in downtown Kansas City. Good morning.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I live in East Village, and it seems like downtown is booming, and I love living down there. But East Village, you know, the eastern part of the downtown loop, does seem to always have talks, and nothing really seems to happen. Do you have any insight if Van Trust is actually going to make something happen in that part of downtown, or...
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Doug. I've been bothering Van Trust for a while. I really thought a few years ago when they took over the development rights to the East Village from Swope that something would be happening. I wish I could give you a good answer. I know that they're capable of doing things. I know they have an idea that they'd like to develop part of it as residential and part of it with offices. I know that there's people talking these days that we need new office space downtown. I wish I could give you a good answer. Are you in that building that Swope built? Because there's really not a lot of that's been developed in the East Village.
No. I live just a block north of there, and there's three big high-rise
houses.
I live in one of those.
Sure.
I live in the Metropolitan. But, yeah, and kind of piggybacking off that, it seems like also that you know, the one thing that's really lacking is people to be able to do like I did and actually invest in a mortgage. So condos downtown. Any thoughts
Boy.
On how
you, it's, you know, my wife and I were actually really seriously trying to find a condo downtown a year ago, and I know exactly what you're saying. What I hear from developers are a couple of things, that they can't get enough money for condos in Kansas City to make it worthwhile, that there's also lending issues that the banks imposed after the big recession that make it difficult for people to get financing to buy a condo. And I guess the other, I'm trying to think of what the third thing, oh, that homeowners associations now have much more clout, and that they can go back and file lawsuits against developers years after these projects get done. Hmm. Those are the three things I've heard. But on the, you know, the other side, I hear Cordish is thinking about maybe doing some condos in their three light project. I'm not quite sure how many. And I do know there are other people like you and me that are interested in buying. And there is, I think some of the developers hopefully are going to pick up and recognize that there's a market of folks that don't want to rent, they want to own.
Kate has a question, Kevin, about from Midtown KC, about the streetcar election. Kate, good morning.
Good morning. This is the first I've heard of this election. I went through considerable efforts to vote in the first round. Can you give us details about voting in the second or today?
Yeah. Well, Kate, it's been all these elections for the Transportation Development District and the Streetcar Extension have been mail-in.
Right.
This is how the courts and this is how the state of Missouri has arranged this. I would strongly recommend that you go to the Kansas City Streetcar website. There are complete instructions on there about how you go about obtaining a ballot. And it's not just today. I think you've got like a week and a half to send in for these ballots. And then there's this mail back in process. So this whole process is going to go for several weeks.
Oh, good, good. So there's time. Oh.
Yeah, yes. It's not like you have to go to the ballot box today.
Okay.
Okay.
Kate,
thanks.
You bet.
You know, Kev, you've been writing a lot about these new apartments going up around town. In fact, they're going up all over the downtown area. Bring us up to speed on what's been happening there.
Well, there's certainly been a tremendous amount of construction, and there's still more in the pipeline. Like we just mentioned, Cordish is before City Hall now trying to get the funding for Three Light, which would be, I think, a 300-unit apartment building. What I've heard is, you know, there is still robust demand, but it has started to soften. You know, a year ago, people who were developing downtown apartment projects were reporting 95% occupancy rates. That's dropped to about 90%. I talked to a couple of folks who really know a lot about the downtown residential market a few weeks ago, and they are mildly concerned that we may be getting into a glut situation. But in some ways, that would be a benefit to folks renting downtown because that would soften the costs. But there are still projects. I mean, there's an outfit that wants to do a 300-unit project over in the East Crossroads, which would be a whole new area for residential development next week. They're breaking ground on a project called The Yards down in the West Bottoms, which would be the first substantial apartment project down there. I think there's almost 300 units. And fairly soon, the Union is what they call it. This major, almost 500-unit apartment project on the riverfront near Berkeley Park is going to start taking occupancy. So
what's the evidence that some of the demand for these apartments is softening?
Well, you know, there's been thousands of new units that have come on, and we've had certainly a strong interest from people in seeking what they call a walkable environment, where you can live somewhere and you can walk out your front door. You don't have to get in a car to go places. Old Overland Park is seeing a really big influx of new apartments coming in there, too. But, you know, a couple of people say, you know, what we really need to do to keep this thing moving forward downtown is we need more jobs downtown. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen some nice moves as far as a few jobs coming into downtown, but we still, you know, need to get more employment going on.
You know, one of the developments is the Three Lights complex from Cordish. They've done the first two lights, I guess. One question that's arisen is whether the city should pay $17 million to build a parking garage beneath the Three Lights building. The project would provide roughly 300 more downtown apartments. What's going to happen there?
Well, that's a great question. I thought the Cordish folks, you know, they got this development agreement with the city back in 2004. that, you know, the city was really desperate
to get
activity,
to get
invest
going.
In downtown. And I got to tell you, you know, I was there Saturday night and downtown was hopping. Mm-hmm. I mean, the district is really doing a lot of what had been originally promised. But, the you know, they had a deal with the city that when they built these apartment buildings, supposedly the city was on the hook to pay for the parking. Well, I just saw the story in the Star. I didn't report this, but that the city attorney says that the city is not legally obligated to furnish this $17.5 million to do this garage for Cordish. Now, there are a lot of people who say, you know, well, this was the intent of what was going on. So I don't know what the answer is going to be. I know a couple of council members have held up this whole thing, asking questions about this. It's been tied into this bigger issue of how do we get more affordable housing downtown?
Right.
You know, we've got several buildings that over the next few years that were built with affordable housing tax credits. They're going to roll off and the developers are going to be able to revert to market rate housing. So it's getting tied up in some of the bigger issues, which in a way we're having growing pains. I mean, gosh, you and I 15 years ago, we'd love to be having these kinds of issues. I mean,
Speaking of growing pains, the other concern is the lack of affordable housing downtown.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's a significant issue too, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, it is. I mean, you know, our Governor Greitens pulled the plug on low housing tax credits, which was a huge part of how people were able to develop these buildings and provide affordable housing. The new tax laws, federal tax laws, people tell me, make it less attractive for corporations to buy these tax credits, both historic and low housing, because, you know, their taxes have been lowered because of the cuts in the federal budget. So it is a tough issue. And I applaud folks who are pushing hard to say, you know, if you're going to get incentives from the city, do something for us in the way of providing this kind of affordable housing so it's not just, you know, limited to people making 50, 60 grand and above.
Tony from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I used to do some consulting work with respect to the historic tax credits. I'm wondering if you'd give an update on the Hawthorne Plaza project and the 3800 block of Main Street.
As far as I know, they're starting to do the renovation. They call it I guess the original name of that building was the Netherlands Hotel. And I know there's been dumpsters out in front of it, and I know that the developer has been working on it. I think that project is now underway.
That's my understanding as well. I just wondered if you could touch on the status of the historic tax credit program and whether that's something that's also on the chopping block potentially with this governor.
Well, I know Greitens wanted to cut it way back. He had some task force come back.
I think the General Assembly's looking at it now.
But from what I'm reading from the folks with Preservation Missouri, I'm not giving it the right name, I know, but people seem to be cautiously optimistic that it's going to dodge the dramatic cuts that were originally talked about this past a couple of months ago when this task force came out with its report. You know, it ain't over till the fat lady sings, as they say. But I think that there is a little bit of a sigh of relief going on in the historic preservation community that this is not going to get as severely cut back as the governor originally talked about.
Allison from Olathe. Allison, you're on with Kevin Collison of City Scene KC. Good morning.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Good morning.
Oh, thank you. Good morning. I just recently started working downtown, and I really enjoy it. I was wondering, for the new construction, like specifically the hotel, how are they going to incorporate or maintain the kind of the historical?
You cut out on
that
us.
Sort of
the historical what, Allison?
Right. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Wait, Allison, the historical what?
Oh, historical stations and buildings that are kind of in place around the new construction, if that's going to be incorporated into the new construction.
Well, where the hotel is going up, they only had to demolish one building, and it was a pretty ugly building. It was the old American Hereford Association.
Right.
So I don't
it's
think
sort of built on a little
there's a parking lot there that the city owned, and then there's this cliff, and then there's this site right across from the ballroom where this American Hereford Association building. So they're not disrupting any historic architecture that I'm aware of. But I would like to add, I had a story today that I think a lot of people would be interested in. You know, there is a new plan that has been released about decking the South Loop between Wyandotte and Grand and putting a park on top of that freeway, which people would love to see that trench go away. It was built in the 60s. It's cut downtown and sliced it off from the crossroads. And it would the new price tag is about $139 million. Previous price tags had been over $200 million. And that would be a way to really connect the hotel with the downtown, with the Power and Light District, Crossroads with downtown, and it would create the kind of green space that some of the folks who live downtown.
So where would that deck be exactly?
It would run all the way from Wyandotte to Grand Boulevard. It's a four-block-long deck
sort
that would
just,
cover the interstate.
Just west of the Sprint Center then.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It would end at the Grand,
okay,
you know, and it would start at Wyandotte. So it would basically knit together the Crossroads with downtown, create a park. It's a price tag. Yeah, $139 million is not cheap, but it's actually something that people can really think is pretty doable. So that's kind of a new, fun concept that is now getting some life downtown.
Well, you wonder how much political push could be behind something like that, given the massive investment in downtown in recent years
and
the
I know there's
clamoring
some
to spend money
City
elsewhere.
Hall these days. Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
sure. Let's go to Greg from Westport. Greg, you're on the air.
Yeah, just wanted to say fondly, I remember Diane Stafford, Kevin Collison, Chris Lester in the good old days at the Star. We actually had adequate staff to do real estate reporting. But welcome back at Kansas City Scene. So my question is, the county acquired this old Rock Island rail line from the county, Jackson County, Cass County line, and I think the terminus on the north is roughly Arrowhead Stadium. And there was a plan, well, they were trying to figure out how to connect it to the streetcar, and that is would be the beginning of a regional rail transit.
Where's the regional rail stand right now?
You know,
Any update there?
I wish I could help.
Not
you
moving
on that.
Ahead too quickly, didn't seem like.
Well, no. I mean, I know that was a huge endeavor and favorite project of Mike Sanders, and of course, his star has fallen. I wish I could tell you where that heavy rail idea is these days. My website really focuses on greater downtown, so I don't get into Eastern Jackson County, and
Just quickly with downtown before you go, Kev, the new downtown music conservatory for UMKC, where are we with that?
Well, it's obviously the site that they'd hoped to build it on across from the Kauffman Center is now off the table. Julie Irene Kauffman withdrew her $20 million pledge. I think folks are still trying to figure out a plan B, but from what I hear, it's likely that anything would happen would be on the UMKC main campus, that the whole idea of the conservatory coming downtown has evaporated, which is sorry. I'm very sorry to hear about that.
We'll have to leave it there. Kevin, thanks for the update.
It was fun.
Kevin Collison, editor-in-chief of City Scene KC. That's your online news site devoted to coverage of the greater downtown area. Kevin, thanks very much.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, how permanent should public art really be? It's a conversation about reckoning with the memorials and monuments that are out of sync with present-day values. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.